On 104.5 FM, this is WRFU LP Urbana. It's 6 p.m. on Thursday, and time for A Critical Ear, presented by Andrew O'Boyle and Robert Naiman.
And we'll start off today's show, as we usually do, with the Panos London News Bulletin for today, the 31st of July 2008. The UN Security Council has voted to end its peacekeeping border mission in Ethiopia and Eritrea. Most peacekeepers have already left the region after Eritrea cut off the mission's fuel and food supplies. It had wanted the UN to ensure that Ethiopia withdrew from disputed territory awarded to Eritrea. UN Security General Ban Ki-moon had previously warned of a return to war if the peacekeepers were pulled out, but Ethiopian Prime Minister Meles Zenawi said he thought that unlikely. Tens of thousands of people died in 2.5 years of war in the region, which began in 1998. Congo's Ministry of Justice says it will release prisoners from overcrowded jails across the country. It recently freed around 200 inmates from a prison in Congo's capital, Kinshasa, upon the recommendation of a judicial commission. The prison, which was built to hold 1,200 prisoners, was holding at least 4,000. Conditions in the DRC's prisons are generally poor. Since January, at least 26 prisoners have died of hunger in the central prison of Mbuji-Mayi in the Kasai Oriental province. Ecuador has asked the US to leave its military airbase in the country when an agreement runs out in 2009. Some 300 US soldiers are stationed in the country where they carry out anti-drug operations. Drug traffickers sending cocaine from Colombia and Peru to the US often go via Ecuador. According to the Foreign Ministry, anti-drug surveillance flights will end in August 2009 and the withdrawal of military staff in November. A draft constitution backed by President Rafael Correa abolishes any foreign military bases. It must now be approved by a popular referendum. Civil society organizations in Niger are calling for a parliamentary inquiry into a multi-billion dollar oil deal with China. Transparency campaigners from the Network of Organizations for Transparency and Budget Analysis, ROTAB, says the contract that gave China's state oil company oil exploration rights was signed in secrecy and lacks public scrutiny. China promises to invest $5 billion in the next 3 years to develop oil production, but the group is calling for a full investigation into how the funds will be spent and to see whether the people of Niger will benefit from the country's oil wealth. North Koreans are experiencing the worst food shortages since the famine of the late 1990s, according to reports from the World Food Programme. It says up to 6 million people are in urgent need of food aid, with almost three-quarters of households cutting their food intake. Many are scavenging for wild foods such as grasses and berries. The assessment also shows an increase in the number of malnourished children going to hospitals. The UN agency says $20 million are needed to help the country until the autumn harvest. The government of Bangladesh has set up a truth commission to tackle corruption. It will allow corrupt businessmen and politicians to avoid jail if they confessed and refund money they obtained illegally. Those who admit to corruption will be barred from contesting elections or taking seats on corporate boards for 5 years. The commission follows a nationwide anti-graft campaign launched by the military-backed government after it took office in 2007. Hundreds of people have been arrested, including prominent figures such as ex-premiers and ministers. Dozens have been given jail sentences of between 5 and 20 years.
Interworld Radio headlines are provided by Interworld Radio, the daily news and feature service from the Panos Institute, London. More information at www.panos.org.uk and www.interworldradio.net. Views expressed on A Critical Ear are those of the speakers and are not intended to represent WRFU, Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Centre, or Urbana Socialist Forum. Feedback is welcome at show@acriticalear.info. More information at acriticalear.info.
And we're back listening to, you are listening to A Critical Ear. We are producing and presenting it. And by we, I mean myself, Andrew O'Boyle, and in studio, Robert Naiman. Good afternoon, Bob.
Good afternoon, Andrew.
And it's been a few weeks since we've actually sat in studio and discussed the state of the world. One of the things we wanted to talk about today, something that came up in the Panos bulletin there at the top of the hour, the moves in Ecuador to ban foreign military bases, by which of course is effectively is a ban or a ban on the current U.S. military base in Ecuador.
Yeah, one base and one foreign of particular interest, being the U.S. air base at Manta. And this isn't news in the sense that for quite some time it's been quite clear that the government in Ecuador does not want to renew the lease. This is not like a big revelation. But what happened this week is that the Foreign Ministry of Ecuador announced that they have formally notified the U.S. Embassy. Before they just said, you know, we're not going to renew this, we're not going to renew this. And there were some indications that the U.S. was trying to see if they could get them to renew it. I think that the, you know, ever since the Colombian attack that was supported by the United States, that was pretty much the end of the story. If there were any chance, that was eliminated. But nonetheless, the formal notification is what it is. Formal notification, like we formally told you that you have to leave. And as also noted in the Interworld headlines on Friday, this was underlined yet again when the Constitutional Assembly approved the draft constitution, which, as you said, had this provision saying no foreign military bases. Even if they hadn't done that, the government had made clear, led by its president, U of I alumnus Rafael Correa, that they weren't going to renew it. Correa had said things like, you know, I'll cut off my arm before I'll renew the base. And he had also said things like,
but what did he really feel about the base?
Yeah, right. He also said things like, you know, conciliatory things like, well, we'd be happy to renew the lease for this base if Ecuador can have a military base in Florida. Interestingly, Stephen Kinzer had a column in The Guardian where he, you know, expounded on this idea that it would be a really great thing if there were a foreign military base in the United States, so that people in the U.S. could, you know what it feels like to have foreign troops stationed on your soil running around. But I don't think that's
strange. I haven't come across that many people other than Kinzer who are keen on the idea of foreign bases in the U.S.
Well, you know, of course, his point being that it should be fair, just like Correa was saying. Correa, you know, I don't think he was really serious. He was just, you know, pointing out. Obviously, this is something that people in Ecuador think is extremely irritating, even more so after the Colombian raid, which many people in Ecuador felt with some justification, not only was supported by the United States, but actively assisted, encouraged, approved beforehand by the United States. And there were even accusations that the base at Manta had been involved in that operation. So this is a very positive thing for Ecuador's sovereignty to get rid of this base. The lease expires in November 2009. And it's a positive thing that the Ecuadorian government has been able so far to fulfill its campaign promise to create a new constitution. But there was also some other interesting news this week related to Ecuador, and that was the report in Newsweek about the lobbying of Chevron relative to this big environmental lawsuit that's going on. It's not yet in the print version. It's in the online edition this week. This article by Michael Iskoff reporting on the efforts by the Chevron Corporation, huge energy corporation based in California, also associated with nefarious dealings in Burma. The Chevron has been sued by thousands of mainly indigenous peasants in Ecuador for environmental damage in the Amazon. This is a liability that Chevron acquired when it purchased Texaco, because it was actually Texaco that was responsible for this toxic dumping in Ecuador. And so there's this lawsuit that's been going on for a while. But the recent development is that there was kind of a preliminary finding of this court-appointed expert that estimated Chevron's liability at something like $10 billion, $8 to $10 billion. So, so Chevron's taking this seriously. They actually reported this to their stockholders as a liability. So they're seeing this as a serious threat. And so what they're doing, rather than, you know, try to negotiate a settlement, is that they sent their lobbyists to Washington to try to bring pressure on the government of Ecuador, including asking the Office of United States Trade Representative to withhold trade access to the U.S. market from Ecuador, to punish the government of Ecuador for not squashing this lawsuit. And this Newsweek article had a really choice quote, which some people may have seen. It was from one of the Chevron lobbyists. The person wasn't named, but had this quote from Chevron lobbyist talking about how, you know, we're trying to, you know, lobby Congress, the administration. So this lobbyist said, you know, what you have here is this corporation being mistreated by the government of Ecuador. And we can have little countries screwing around with big corporations. So I think Common Dreams, when they reprinted this article from Newsweek, like, that quote was the headline, you know, little countries screwing around with big corporations. So, and in fact, I think this scandal is going to grow because it's so
obvious.
You know, it's so obvious. It's so extreme. Chevron is such a blatant jerk corporation. Sorry to have to use the word jerk there, but, you know, we do have SEC guidelines. But another interesting thing about this, so it's a really extreme case. So extreme that Senator Obama, our dear senator, today he's our dear senator, because he did something good too, according to the Newsweek article. In 2006, he and Senator Leahy sent, this case has been going on for a while, sent a letter to USTR saying, stay out of this. You know, the, you know, without prejudging the outcome of this case, these thousands of peasants in Ecuador deserve their day in court. And we shouldn't interfere with the rule of law in Ecuador. So this, you know, this case has been going on for some time. Predates the current government of Ecuador. But obviously, the current government of Ecuador is sympathetic to the case.
And indeed, predates the U.S. presidential election season.
Well, right. And so, in fact, right, this is before Senator Obama sent this letter. Before he was a candidate, and according to the Newsweek article, in fact, he was, I think, roommates at Harvard with one of the lawyers in the case. So there was a personal connection, and this guy, you know, went to see his old friends that are around and said, you know, by the way, this corporation, Chevron, is trying to use the power of the U.S. government to jerk with these peasants in Ecuador. And Chevron's hire these lobbyists tied to McCain and so on and so forth. So more good news is that apparently Obama, you know, was recently asked, or his staff was recently asked, you know, is this still your position? And a spokesman from Obama said, absolutely, this is still our position. You know, we support the rule of law in Ecuador, and these people deserve their day in court. So I'm hopeful that with this Newsweek article and some other things that I have cooked up, and I'm sure that, you know, there's lots of people are paying attention to this now. There's groups that have been working on this for a long time, obviously, Amazon Watch and others, that this is going to be a free hit on USTR. The Office of U.S. Trade Representatives. Oh, so it mentioned in this Newsweek article, not only that Chevron had asked the Office of U.S. Trade Representative, which is part of the executive branch, which negotiates trade agreements and, among other parts of the government, monitors their compliance of other countries' agreement and uses its power to monitor this compliance to threaten other countries. So the Newsweek article reported not only that Chevron had asked USTR to intervene in this way by withholding trade benefits from Ecuador, but that USTR confirmed, spokesman for USTR Susan Schwab, confirmed that they are considering Chevron's request. So I think this is going to be a great scandal. And just today... Peter DeFazio's office, Democrat of Oregon, who's been, you know, one of the leaders in the House for years on fair trade issues, started circulating a letter to USTR saying, you know, stay out. These people deserve their day in court, and including the Newsweek article and the money quote from the Chevron lobbyist. So I think that we're going to get a bunch of people to sign this letter. And so I'm very happy about this little scandal.
And when you say, you know, bringing attention to the Office of the Trade Representative, kind of bringing some light perhaps to the way in which the power of the government is bent to the will and the interests of corporate and business interests.
Yeah, actually, you know, that's exactly right. I mean, I think it's a great example. I mean, these kinds of things are going on all the time. Every once in a while, something happens that's like really extreme and sticks out and provides a great opportunity for everyone to pile on. And as you say, illustrate the underlying things that are happening all the time. You know, if you were to say, you know, the U.S. government is controlled by corporations doing the bidding, you know, someone might accuse you of vulgar Marxism and you know, say, well, you know, okay, this is just a generalization. Of course, the reality more is complicated. But in the case of USTR, like, vulgar Marxism is really true.
Because that's its role.
And that's how it explicitly sees in this role. I was in a meeting with someone from USTR, a bunch of NGOs, a couple years ago, you know, NGOs in Washington, like environmental groups, public interest groups, occasionally meet with USTR. So I was in one of these meetings. And this guy from USTR said, in this meeting with NGOs, my job, our job, the job of our office is to promote the interests of U.S. corporations. That's what he said. I can't, like, you know, accuse him of that because he said it.
And he may, you know, just have been reading from their mission statement.
Well, I mean, he wasn't reading from anything. He was reading from his brain, you know, his values that he had internalized. But, you know, you might think that the job of the Office of U.S. Trade Representative is to represent the interests of the American people as a whole, you know, including corporations and including everyone else. But no, according to him, his job is to represent the interests of U.S. corporations. So I think this is a good wedge issue to kind of illustrate an attack. And they've been doing, of course, doing horrible, you know, like USTR threatens developing countries when these countries consider issuing a compulsory license for patent-protected medicines in order to deal with public health issues, even though they have the right to do this under the rules of the World Trade Organization. But they're intimidated from actually exercising their right by these threats that happen behind the scenes. So it's a great opportunity to bring USTR into the light of public scrutiny.
No, you were going to move elsewhere in South America, staying in South America, Bolivia. What has been happening in Bolivia in recent days or weeks?
So the thing that I wanted to call folks' attention to, of course, there is a tremendous dispute going on in Bolivia about efforts to revise the constitution. As in Venezuela and Ecuador, the current government came in part on a promise to revise the constitution and to revise government policies to benefit the majority rather than the narrow elite. Bolivia, in some ways, is an extreme case relative, even though you have the same dynamics, many of the same dynamics as in Venezuela and Ecuador. Bolivia is a more extreme case in the sense, first of all, it's a much poorer country. Secondly, the history of racism in Bolivia against the indigenous majority is arguably even more extreme than in Venezuela and Ecuador. And also now, in reaction, the reaction to the reform efforts of the democratically elected government is also more extreme. There's some kind of, you know, signs of sort of autonomy movements in Ecuador. It's not zero. But in Bolivia, you've actually had, in recent months, these opposition provinces, the governors of these opposition provinces, actually conducting autonomy, so-called autonomy referendum, illegal autonomy referendum. But so you have these autonomy movements in these, you know, disproportionately rich, disproportionately white or disproportionately European areas of the country. And you have, there's a very tense situation in Bolivia right now. And many supporters of the government accuse the United States government, with some evidence, of backing these essentially illegal autonomy movements, which have really nasty elements, you know, being racist and being basically, you know, they try to portray themselves and are sometimes portrayed in the U.S. media as being just kind of innocuous. Oh, who's against autonomy? You know, just like we have in the U.S., you know, the state of Illinois has some autonomy. But the agenda here, arguably, is to block this process of national reform and prevent the national Bolivian government from carrying through on its campaign promises to address the extreme inequality in the country.
It's essentially, it's our pie, we don't want to share it, and we're going to
it's our pie, take and go home. We don't want to share it, and not even a little bit. And of course you have this same dynamic historically in Venezuela and Ecuador and elsewhere, but in the case in Bolivia, is even more extreme, and the stakes are really high. The Center for Economic and Policy Research came out with a paper this week talking about these dynamics, the fact that the land concentration in these provinces is very extreme, even relative to the rest of Latin America, the rest of the country, that these provinces already have a receiving disproportionate share of the national gas revenues, and that these autonomy movements are aimed at preventing any redistribution from taking place. So I wanted to bring that to attention, because this is something that is it's not zero, but hardly being reported in the U.S. media at all. And much of the reporting has been such as it has existed. The whole thing is not being reported at all, largely, but reports that have happened have really, by and large, failed to explain these dynamics. I mean, it's really a kind of apartheid-like situation that has existed in Bolivia. You have a democratic government that's trying to address the situation, and then you have these autonomy movements that are essentially trying to preserve the apartheid in their provinces.
Bolivia came to my mind when you started talking about the poverty and the extreme inequality there. I was in I was in Portland, as you know, this past week at the Grassroots Radio Conference, and was reminded over the weekend that the first, what's believed to be the first community radio station in the world, was actually founded in Bolivia by mine workers as part of their campaign. I think this could be back as far as the 1930s or early 1940s, in order to try to have some voice in their own conditions as an organizing tool, essentially. But so much of the history of Bolivia is about, as you say, the large majority of the population being exploited, the resources of the country being exploited in mining and similar industries for the benefits of the benefit of these small of these minority rich, largely European or white populations.
Yes, and that in sort of what's on the table now is, kind of FDR type effort to address that inequity, and it's a sign of the extremism of these elites, part of these elites that, you know, are willing not willing to accept even a moderate reform, and are willing to turn to extra legal and even violent means to try and preserve all of their privileges.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that the situation in Bolivia in terms of segregation, in terms of, you termed it a form of apartheid, being more extreme than both Ecuador and Venezuela, both of which have also had leftist or progressive or leaders come to the fore. What's the situation in Venezuela? We've talked about the first two, Ecuador and Bolivia. What's new in Venezuela? Have there been any noteworthy developments in the past week or so?
Well, one thing, it's certainly not of the scale or intensity, but I thought might be of interest to some listeners. I certainly found it interesting. It was reported this week, both in the Philadelphia Inquirer and subsequent AP story, that the Venezuelan government has now undertaken a new program for marketing Venezuelan coffee in the United States produced by cooperatives in Venezuela. And they're doing this through the network of Citgo gas stations, as many people are aware. The Citgo gas stations in the United States, the Citgo Corporation, is completely owned by the government of Venezuela. It's a subsidiary of PDVSA, the Venezuela's national oil company. So, of course, the government of Venezuela for some time has been trying to diversify the economy. They have this, dynamic, which is sort of well-known around the world, of the oil industry sort of sucking the oxygen out of everything else. And Venezuela used to be a coffee exporter, but in recent years, its exports have fallen as oil industry came to dominate everything. So one of the programs for some time of the policies of the current government is to try to diversify the economy and to promote other exports. One of the exports they want to promote is coffee, and they have coffee cooperatives that are working with the government in this program for exports. So now apparently it's the case. It's not necessarily true in every Citgo station, but it may even be the case in the Citgo station that's west of Champaign that you can now get Venezuelan coffee. I want to verify this. So anybody, has been by that station recently, they should call us and let us know if they're selling Venezuelan coffee. But it may be increasingly the case that you can get coffee from Venezuelan coffee cooperatives at Citgo gas stations. And these, according to this program, the coffee cooperatives are required to allocate a share of their profits to constructing schools and clinics and roads in the coffee producing areas. So if you want to know where your coffee dollar is going, that if some part of it is going to constructing those things in the areas of the coffee producing cooperatives in Venezuela.
Yes, very good, a noteworthy development in terms of leveraging the infrastructure, leveraging the dominant industry you already have in order to...
We're drinking coffee anyway.
Yeah. Well, this is it.
Someone could quibble whether we ought to be drinking coffee at all. I wouldn't argue that. But given that we're drinking coffee, might as well do something good with it. Supposedly, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer, I don't know, I haven't drank the stuff myself. I mean, I had coffee when I was in Venezuela, but I haven't, you know, been, this program hasn't been around enough for me to take advantage of it. But according to the article on the Philadelphia Inquirer, it was really playing up the, you know, sort of pure coffee aspect of it. And some people claim that this coffee is really tasty. So I can't independently verify that. But it was in the Philadelphia Inquirer. It must be true.
And as you say, people might stop by the one west of Champaign and let us know what their experience is like.
We used to have one on 57 north of town, but that flipped to something else. But there's still one in Mahomet.
Okay.
You're listening to A Critical Ear on WRFU Urbana, an open forum for the Urbana-Champaign community. Views expressed are those of the speakers and are not intended to represent WRFU, Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, or Urbana Socialist Forum. You too can have a show on WRFU. Go to wrfu.net or radiofreeurbana.org for details. More information on A Critical Ear, including podcasts and further discussion of topics raised on air, at our website, acriticalear.info.
Now, Bob, I don't want to say we've finished with Latin America, but we've gone through a number of stories there. Over to the other, well, to another part of the world, and Iran. We've been talking a lot about the diplomacy and the tensions that have been raised there. The resolution that was before Congress calling for essentially a blockade of Iran by the U.S. in order to prevent oil products going back into Iran. What sort of developments have there been in relation to Iran in the past week or two?
Well, first of all, on the thing that you just mentioned, the last couple of days, yet another member of Congress who originally agreed to co-sponsor that resolution, House Concurrent Resolution 362, which I'm sorry to say our own representative, Tim Johnson, is co-sponsor of. But the good news is, I was going to talk about good news. The good news is that Danny Davis, who's a representative from Chicago, removed his name from the resolution this week, bringing the total up to four members of Congress.
There's four who have removed
withdrawn
themselves.
Their names from this resolution being promoted by the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And, of course, the other good news, like our prayer, you know, yet another day has gone by, and this resolution hasn't moved because it, you know, became controversial. And I think this is a noteworthy, you know, so far, the noteworthy victory in that, you know, 6 weeks ago, this resolution already had like 130 sponsors being promoted aggressively by the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which has its reputation as the most powerful lobby in Washington, which is powerful, but it's not all powerful or invincible. So I think this example indicates, because a bunch of groups started putting the word out. Of course, nobody, you know, 2 months ago, almost nobody in the country had heard of this resolution. But when it looked like it was about to pass, then a bunch of groups got involved in putting out alerts and trying to engage the broad public in this. And as a result, there has been a lot of friction around this. A month and a half ago, when my colleague Chelsea Mosen was with Stephen Kinzer, they were going around Washington, they met with an aide to Speaker Pelosi. And Pelosi's aide said, this is going to pass through Congress like a hot knife through butter. Well,
they were confident it was going to happen? Or was this a supporter of it?
No, I don't think he was. I mean, I don't think he was necessarily supporting, just saying, look, you know, this is, don't talk to me about this. This is a lost cause, you know,
okay,
because this is just going to go through. And in fact, the attitude among some offices was like, you know, let's just throw AIPAC a bone. You know, they want some kind of "we hate Iran" thing, so this is kind of harmless. The thing is, these people didn't read the resolution. It's not harmless. You know, it doesn't just restate the usual insults. It demands that the president work to impose an embargo, a blockade against Iran. It doesn't use the word blockade, but it talks about cutting off their gas imports, prohibiting their gas imports, demands inspections of all cargo going into or out of Iran. It's an extreme...
Which is what a blockade would be.
You know, it's like a long-winded description of a blockade. So, so it is really extreme. Bob? And when... you know, when people started pounding on these congressional offices, you know, like Barney Frank, for example, it's like, oh, yeah. And then he admitted that he hadn't read it carefully and he apologized for it, much to his credit. So I think that's really that's good news to report. AIPAC is not invincible. They as yet have not had their way on this. Less good news is that this weekend, this upcoming weekend, is the deadline on the ultimatum that the United States and its European friends gave to Iran to accept their freeze-for-freeze proposal. And the freeze-for-freeze proposal being that... Iran would agree to freeze the expansion of its capacity to enrich uranium in exchange the United States and its friends would freeze the expansion of their efforts to impose sanctions on Iran. And this is supposed to be take place for a 6-week period in preparation for formal talks. The position of the Bush administration is still that formal talks cannot begin unless Iran suspends completely the enrichment of uranium. So the bad news is that although there was, you know, there was something positive in the sense that the U.S. got more engaged in some kind of diplomatic process. They sent the third-ranking diplomat to Geneva for these talks 2 weeks ago Saturday. The bad news is that, in part because the position of the Bush administration hasn't really shifted that much, there is every sign that Iran won't agree to this, and so this episode will expire, and the Bush administration will then be able to say, look, you know, we tried diplomacy. You told us to try diplomacy. We tried diplomacy, and now we have to do something else. The immediate prospect, according to the statements of Bush administration officials, is that they'll go for more sanctions in the UN. But the danger is that a trigger is set up. You're supposed to go to the UN. They don't get the sanctions they want. Then you know, they could say, they would have basis, their point of view of saying, look, we tried diplomacy, we tried sanctions, and, you know, we can't get effective, strong enough sanctions, so we have to do something else. So that makes the situation dangerous. And it's in this context that University of Illinois law professor Francis Boyle has publicly suggested that the Iranian government should sue the United States in the world court to get an injunction against the United States for its threats to attack Iran. It is the case, a fact almost completely unremarked in U.S. public discourse. Not only would it be illegal under international law, a serious violation, arguably the most serious violation of the U.N. Charter.
An act of aggression.
If the United States were to launch a military attack on Iran, another U.N. member state signatory to the Charter. But it's also illegal under the Charter for the United States to threaten to attack Iran. As I said, this is completely unremarked, and one of the things that I find compelling about Professor Boyle's proposal is that I would like to insert this fact into discussion, that it's illegal for the United States not only to attack Iran, but also to threaten to attack Iran under the UN Charter. So this week, I actually learned about Professor Boyle's statement from an interview we did with Press TV, and subsequently we conducted a short interview with Professor Boyle, which is now on YouTube. And I'm very pleased to report that since I posted this Monday morning, the video on YouTube has gotten 1,500 hits, 1,500 views. So in addition to people that read the blogs on Common Dreams and Huffington Post. A lot more. So, you know, some kind of awareness and discussion has been generated around this fact that threatening Iran has a violation of international law. And Professor Boyle points out in this interview that there is a precedent that in 1992, the first Bush administration was threatening to attack Libya. Libya sued the U.S. and Britain and the World Court, and the World Court agreed to hear the case, and those preliminary proceedings in the World Court actually helped compel the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, to back down from its threats. And not only that, but the legal proceedings in the World Court actually themselves created an interaction between the United States and Libya that didn't exist before. In other words, there were Libya, by suing, created negotiations with the United States.
Created a space in which they could be facilitated.
In which the United States had to respond. Mm-hmm. And so then and at that time, the U.S. and Libya didn't have diplomatic relations. So the lawyers for Libya and the United States were essentially conducting negotiations. And those negotiations eventually produced an agreement. And now today, the United States and Libya have diplomatic relations.
And the United States and Iran do not have, rather, there is no U.S. mission in Tehran.
The United
at the
States
moment.
And Iran do not have diplomatic relations. Mm-hmm. The there is an Iran interest section in Washington, but it doesn't relate to the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. It's not an embassy in that sense. It carries out some functions of an embassy, like issuing visas.
So it's consular functions rather than diplomatic functions.
It's like a consulate. Mm-hmm. And the Bush administration, to its credit, has floated for some time now, actually, the idea of creating an analog in Tehran, a U.S. interest section in Tehran. And this week, I think it was this week, I saw it this week, seven senators, including Senator Kerry, Senator Feinstein, Senator Feingold, have written to the Bush administration praising this report. I mean, essentially floated in the media that they're considering doing this. But they have gotten encouragement from these seven senators saying, yes, this is a good idea. You should open a U.S. Intersection in Tehran. After all, this is completely consistent. Doing so would be completely consistent with statements by Bush administration officials like Secretary of Defense Gates that, you know, we should have more people-to-people exchanges, we should have more Iranian students studying in the U.S., all of which is to the good from a humanitarian point of view. I mean, you know, aren't we all for more Iranian students studying in the U.S.? And right now pain in the posterior. If you're a student in Iran, you want to study in the U.S., you have to actually leave Iran to apply for a visa to come to the United States. So, you know, all reasonable people agree that this would be a good thing for the U.S. to have some diplomatic representation in Tehran, as well as the fact, you know, that would create there. Then you would have U.S. government officials in Tehran who could talk to Iranians there and create an independent channel of information to the United States government, which I think would be a positive thing. So people were saying, you know, people in Washington were saying blah, blah, blah. You'd have this channel, the State Department channel, where people would be able to say, well, actually, no, our U.S. diplomats in Tehran say that's not really true. Mm-hmm. So I think that would be a positive thing for U.S. foreign policy.
If I may go back to the Francis Boyle proposal, and I'll make sure we will link to that YouTube video from acriticalear.info later today or early tomorrow. You mentioned his proposal is for Iran to sue and seek an injunction from the International Court of Justice, right?
Right.
Also, the World Court, as people know it.
Yes.
I'm not incredibly familiar with it, other than knowing a little about its name and some of the cases that have been taken in the past. I wasn't familiar with its power of injunction. Is this the injunction, though, would cover preventing U.S. officials from threatening?
That's correct.
So this is to prevent them from doing what they're currently doing, as you said, threatening aggression and threatening invasion against Iran.
Exactly, both of those things. Threatening, attacking, preventing them from attacking Iran, and preventing them from threatening to attack Iran. And some, you know, cynical people might reasonably say, well, how is that going to stop the Bush administration? It's true, of course, that the World Court doesn't have any troops.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bush administration clearly...
Does.
Yeah, it does. Has a lot of troops.
Sorry, go ahead.
But so the Bush administration, physically, the World Court can't prevent the United States from doing anything. However, I mean, that was true in 1992 when mm-hmm. Libya sued the World Court. Obviously, political things and international legal things matter. The Reagan administration in the 1980s renounced the jurisdiction of the World Court when Nicaragua sued the United States for when the CIA mined Nicaragua's harbors. But I think the dynamic in this case would be different. This isn't Nicaragua in 1986. This is Iran 2008. The Bush administration is pursuing a strategy that involves European countries, and if there were a ruling or a proceeding against the Bush administration at The Hague, I think this would be a hard thing for the Bush administration to ignore.
Mm-hmm. So apart from the normative power of the World Court to kind of force a course of action or prevent a course of action through moral authority, as you've mentioned earlier, apart from that, it would create a space of direct interaction between the two governments, where, you know, through their lawyers, who would be the people who would likely be engaged in any direct negotiations in any event, you would have some sort of interaction about these issues of these contentious issues. And perhaps making space for formal negotiations, qua negotiations.
Yes, and in any event, there's no harm in having more than one track.
Mm-hmm. Leaving Iran to one side, and heading a little west, Iraq. What has been happening in Iraq of note in the past few weeks?
The Bush administration is still negotiating with the Iraqi government on a so-called security agreement. Now today is July 31st. That was the deadline that the Bush administration had originally set for trying to get an agreement. At the end of the year, at the end of December, the current mandate, United Nations mandate, for the U.S. and other forces, mainly the U.S., will expire. And so if nothing else happens and there is no, as yet, the United States and Iraq have not asked the Security Council to renew the mandate. Of course, they could ask them on December 15th and it could be renewed. But they haven't asked for that. Both the U.S. government and the Iraqi government earlier said they didn't want to renew the UN mandate. They wanted to have a direct bilateral agreement. Unfortunately for them, the agreement that they originally set out to create proved to be very controversial, both in Iraq and in the United States. And also, they had very serious disagreements between them, particularly because the Bush administration was trying to create a long-term agreement that would essentially bind, or critics charge bind, both the future Iraqi government and the U.S. government, and as well as giving broad latitude for action to the U.S. Occupation force. So things that they have fought about, the U.S. and the Iraqi government, include the question of immunities for U.S. contractors, question of immunity for U.S. soldiers, restrictions on the use of Iraqi territory and Iraqi airspace for military action on other countries, question of whether the Iraqi government will have veto over U.S. military operations. And the good news is that the Bush administration has backed off considerably from its initial wish list, in part because of significant part because of Iraqi government resistance, which in turn reflects overwhelming Iraqi public opinion, as well as the fact that the Iraqi government has essentially used the political U.S. political dynamics as leverage against the Bush administration. So you had the wonderful dynamic where Senator Obama goes to visit Iraq, Obama having been attacked by the Bush administration, Republicans, and Senator McCain for supporting a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. forces. Prime Minister Maliki goes to do an interview with the German news magazine Der Spiegel and says, well, actually, we like what this Obama guy is saying a lot, and we think that this is a great idea to have a timetable for U.S. withdrawal. And he puts forward a slightly different timetable, but, you know, like,
it's still a couple months later,
but basically the same idea, and saying we really like this. Well, so of course, you know, Maliki is using this leverage against the Bush administration because it puts the Bush administration and Senator McCain in a very awkward position. They're attacking Obama, congressional Democrats, saying, oh, you naive wimps, you want to have a timetable for withdrawal from Iraq. And then the Iraqi government, again, reflecting Iraqi public opinion, says exactly the same thing. So as a result of this dynamic and the pressure of the election seasons coming both in the United States and Iraq, obviously we have elections in November in the U.S., but also in theory or by agreement, there's supposed to be Iraqi provincial elections before the year is out. Those have been delayed. The parliament and the government still haven't agreed on a law for that election. They have an emergency session this week. The earliest it could happen is now December. It's not clear that even will be able to happen. But in any event, there's a kind of prevailing political climate in Iraq now of upcoming election. And upcoming elections can have a wonderful effect on politics, in that, you know, puts politicians under greater scrutiny, and that dynamic's happening in Iraq as it's happened in the United States. So there's a tremendous political pressure on the Iraqi government not to agree, not to sign an agreement with the United States that doesn't include some kind of timetable or goal or vision or schedule or whatever you want to call it, talking about the withdrawal of U.S. troops and envisioning a situation in the future when there will not be U.S. troops occupying the country.
Can I ask a question which may be somewhat naive, but one of the issues that one of the statements that the Bush administration has repeatedly made is we are not seeking permanent U.S. bases in Iraq. Much of what I hear about surrounding this security agreement or status agreement for the U.S. seems to indicate open-ended presence of U.S. troops in Iraq. How are the two, you know, those two views to be reconciled? Are the Bush administration simply lying, or are they being careful with their choice of phrasing? Or am I mistaken?
Well, I think they are lying in the sense that, you know, they're being kind of Clintonian. I don't think that there's any question that an original goal of the U.S. invasion in 2003 was to create permanent U.S. military bases in Iraq, permanent base of operations. Now, of course, permanent, nothing is permanent in this life, and everybody knows that, but let's say enduring, which is actually a term that they do use. So there's no Bush administration document you can point to and say, you know, the plan for permanent bases. But it's definitely the case that in their plans for some time, in their plans today, military bases that are going to be there for a long time. That's what they want. So they're being insincere or disingenuous, to say the least, when they say, oh, we don't have any plans for a permanent basis. They know, of course, that this formulation, permanent basis, is very controversial, both in the United States and especially in Iraq. You ask Iraqis, you know, how do you feel about permanent U.S. bases in Iraq? They're against it. If you ask people in the United States how to feel about permanent U.S. bases in Iraq, they're against it. So in that sense, I think that they're insincere. Now, the Iraqi government has tried to push back against that in this agreement by, for example, saying that the agreement should have a sunset. And the mandate or the authority for the operations of U.S. troops should have to be renewed. So that's a way to make it not be permanent. If you have to, you know, like even the see what happens with the Manta base that we spoke about earlier in Ecuador. There was a lease, and the lease had a date. And that meant that after that date, in order for the base to stay, it had to be renewed. So that's what you do, like particularly if you're, you know, let's say in a weak position, you say, okay, well, let's have a date. You know, maybe a future government will be in a stronger position. So that's what I think the Iraqis are saying. You know, right now, from the point of view of the Iraqi government, they don't want the status quo to continue. They are leery about, you know, they don't want the U.S. military to leave right away either, but they don't want to get sucked into a long-term framework of the U.S. being there forever. They say, okay, well, let's have an agreement, but let's have the agreement have an expiration. And then, you know, if the somebody wants to continue this, then it'll have to be renewed. So that's one way that people in the Iraqi government are trying to get at this issue of, you know, how do you prevent permanent U.S. military bases.
Okay. We've about 30 seconds left on the show. If you can, Afghanistan, anything noteworthy that people should know or note about the developments there in the past week or so?
Yes. I think that there's much more evidence in the last couple of weeks of people beginning to speak about the U.S. not, you know, how do we address what the U.S. is doing in Afghanistan? Obama's called for more troops. More and more people are complaining about that. Even Thomas Friedman, in his column in the New York Times, criticized Obama's call for sending more troops to Afghanistan.
A Critical Ear presents news and commentary about a range of topical issues from international affairs to the labor movement. It is produced and broadcast from the studios of WRFU in Urbana, Illinois. Our website includes show archives and further discussion of topics discussed on air. For more information, go to acriticalear.info or contact us by email at show@acriticalear.info. Twitter updates at @acriticalear. Views expressed on A Critical Ear are those of the speakers and are not intended to represent WRFU, Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, or Urbana Socialist Forum. WRFU LP Urbana on 104.5 FM, your community radio station.